When looking for the King of Podcasts, you're at the wrong channel.
Well, excuse me!
Looking for good ideas for life? You're far from good hands.
Hey, bud, what's your problem?
If you think the listener is always right, you're far from the right place.
Out of order! Even in the future, nothing works!
Hosted by a Northeasterner by birth, but a rebel by choice.
Are you threatening me?
If you want a host that floats between love and madness,
and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite, looking forward to a little afternoon delight.
Then play on and listen to Crazy Train Radio.
All right, guys, listen to this blues riff and B. Watch me for the changes and try and keep up, okay?
Warning, creators of this game do understand the subject matter may be offensive to some, but they do honor the families and people that have been affected by these real life tragedies that these individuals have caused. Want to play a game?
Oh yeah!
Lover of true crime?
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, we got an interesting game for you to check out.
Wow.
With the mashup of influences such as horror movies, collecting cards, and RPGs.
What?
Led to giving birth to an incredible creation of this game, Killers the Card Game.
You are all my children now.
This game is a collectible trading card game featuring some of the most infamous killers with tidbits of trivia on the back of each card to help you learn some insight to each criminal.
Who the hell are you?
Let's not forget, during the game, cops will be chasing you and these criminals.
I'm a cop, you idiot!
However, check out their website listed through all social media today, which can be found under Killers the Card Game.
Am I on the internet?
I want to play a game.
Hi, this is Matt Singer from Screen Crush and the author of Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever, and you're listening to Crazy Train Radio.
Hey folks, it's your least favorite host in the podcast world, Croc, Jonathan Steele. Boy, do we have a good one for you today.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, this next guest is a film critic, editor, blogger, author, podcaster, and on-air host. He is the editor-in-chief at Screen Crush, and he's got a new book out, Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Let's welcome Mr. Matt Singer. So, let's welcome Mr. Singer, author of Opposable Thumbs. Yeah, you got my hard copy here. But how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I can't complain. Well, I can, but nobody gives a shit. So, how's the response been for the book? I know it's been out since October, so.
It's been good. I still, every day get you know, a message on Facebook or a message on Instagram or a message on my website, you know, a little note saying, oh, I just finished the book. It was great. And that's lovely. It's nice because it's like, yeah, it's out there in the world now and, you know, people are discovering it still. And yeah, those getting these nice little notes. So those are really nice to receive every day or so. I get a new one from somewhere and it always cheers me up. It's nice.
That's good to hear because I, you know, with everybody I talk to, there's the delayed reaction, as I call it, say if something like the book or a movie or TV, whatever the case is, it's a delayed reaction to when it's going to be in the world, like you just said, or if it's a live reaction, as I call it, whether it be sports, theater, whatever the case, where you have the live audience. Yeah, so, but it's nice to hear that now that it's out in the world, you're getting a good response. But I'm curious to know, and I know there's so many different things, and we'll break them down, obviously, Siskel and Ebert, but what would you say is the main way or main reason that Roger and Gene changed things as far as changing not only the movies, but the reactions to movies?
Well, the main way would be just the sort of format that they really helped pioneer. They didn't necessarily create it because the show was the invention of, well, it's discussed in the book, but potentially a bunch of different people kind of all coming together at WTTW, the PBS station in Chicago, which is where the original version of Siskel and Ebert, which had multiple different titles, but was not called Siskel and Ebert. But that was where the show first launched. And that original show, which they were the hosts of, really was the place that kind of invented this idea of, instead of film criticism being a monologue, why not make it a dialogue? Why not have two critics or two movie lovers or anybody talking about movies, going back and forth on a movie? So it's not just one person giving you their authoritative opinion. You have potentially two authoritative opinions and they might disagree wildly and they might be a little upset about the fact that they disagree wildly. And that idea of film criticism as a conversation and a debate and a dialogue just really didn't exist before the show. It was all one person giving you their one opinion. And, you know, kind of broadly beyond that, while there were sort of discussions and debates and things like that on television and even before that on radio, they were much more civil and polite and amicable. And Siskel and Ebert could very often, when they would debate things, it got heated, it got angry, they would be upset, they would be obstinate with each other, they would, you know, you could, and it's, you know, it's very easy to see they really got annoyed and flustered sometimes. And that was also something that was pretty unique at the time and a big reason why they became successful. And, you know, even though they're obviously not on the air anymore and there really isn't a show like it on the air anymore in the world of film, I think you can see a lot of that influence of that format and that idea of, well, it's kind of fun to watch people like yell at each other on television in so many different areas of TV now, in the worlds of sports and politics and news. It's kind of filtered out into those places. So yeah, their influence on television and on the world of film criticism is really enormous.
But would you say it was, and excuse me if I pronounce this wrong, but was it Thea Flom that had a major influence in what the show became? Because obviously the pilot may or may not have been so fantastic.
Yeah, it was not fantastic. Yes, she. They always gave her the lion's share of the credit for their success. She did not create the show. She was not involved in the original pilot. When I was mentioning, oh, there's different people at WTTW who kind of all came together to make the show, and pretty much all of them liked to claim that they were the ones who created the show. So there's some sort of debate over like who was the singular creator of the show. And it really, to me, in my opinion, at least based on my interviews and research, it's kind of impossible to say because they all claim that they created it. And I think probably it is one of those you know, success has many fathers type situations. But what, whoever was responsible, it was not Thea Flum. She didn't create the show. She was not involved in any way in the original pilot. But after the pilot was made, and not fantastic, at a certain point shortly thereafter, one of the executives at WTTW came to Thea Flum, who was working there. She had produced some other things for the network that had been very successful, and they had brought her in to become like a producer on staff. And one of the executives came to her and said, "Do you like movies?" And she said, "Yeah, I like movies. And, you know, would you like to produce this show about movies?" And she said, "Sure, that sounds cool." And that was it. That was how she kind of got involved with the show. And Roger and Gene always said that she was the one who turned them into Siskel and Ebert, this very successful, famous, marketable, recognizable brand in the world of television, because they were so rough and uncomfortable and not very good at talking, relating to one another on camera, all those sorts of things. And they said she was the one who really worked with them to become not just good print film critics, but good television film critics, and how to sit on camera, how to talk to the camera, how to talk to each other, how to write for television, which is very different than writing for a print audience. All of those things that might seem very simple and obvious to us, they were kind of difficult for Siskel and Ebert as they were getting started. And they said it was really to her credit that she worked with them. They would go to her house on weekends. They would, you know, she would like sit at her kitchen table with them and go over their scripts and go over their, you know, line readings and just kind of, and their comfort levels, and just really help them figure out how to do what they did very successfully in print, and how to do the fact that they didn't really like each other off camera, how to bring that on camera in a way that was very, you know, very TV friendly and very entertaining.
Well, you just hit a couple nails that I'm certainly going to bring up. But as far as their different styles and approaches in how they reviewed stuff, how would you describe that? But also, I would say definitely at their peak, according to research, and we know everything online is true, that at their peak, they were reaching a weekly audience of several million, and on a salary level, probably close to $1 million each. But how would you say the styles differed and approach for when they reviewed stuff?
Well, I mean, there, to some extent, they were similar, because they were both, you know, they were both, you know, daily newspaper film critics by trade. That was how they got their start, at least as film critics. So they sort of came from a similar world. It's not like one wrote newspaper reviews and one wrote 12,000 word essays for an academic journal. So to some extent, they did have a kind of similar similar foundation, let's say. But yeah, they did have different taste, as all critics do, different taste, different likes, different dislikes, different blind spots. And so when you say like, what was the differences, I guess it's stuff like that. It's sort of how they approached movies, what kinds of movies they tended to like or tended to dislike, or be more, let's say, more be suspicious of, or be more, you know, inviting of, you know. And then, yeah, they did some, to some extent, they did have different styles. Oh, I think that was probably more evident in their print work than on the show. On the show, certainly they had different opinions, different taste, but they both basically used the same format, which if you watch the show, you're familiar with. In print, they had sort of different prose styles, different approaches. Siskel's reviews were always much more kind of like a reporter, kind of reporting on what he saw. And Ebert's could tend to be a little bit more, I don't want to say poetic, but just, I don't know, a little more sort of like from the heart, a little more flowery, let's say. That was more of his kind of just personal style, you know. And, you know, he was a Pulitzer Prize winner as a film critic, and, you know, had a little bit more of that side of it to his writing. Yeah, those are sort of the basics. There's other ways, you know, like you'd have to write a whole book to describe all the differences between them, but that's a pretty good start.
Which, strangely enough, I have this book in front of me called Opposable Thumbs. You may have heard of it. But with those differences, would you say that is what made them great frequent talk show guests?
Sure. Well, it certainly made it made everything about their chemistry work. If they were so similar, they never would have been successful, because the whole basis for their show and for the concept was to have disagreements and differences of opinion. So if every episode they were just looking at movies the exact same way and they had the same opinion about everything, people would have probably tuned out very quickly, and the show would never have become the pop culture staple that it was for a quarter of a century. And yes, it also helped them on talk shows as well, because they were very comfortable. Once they did settle into a rhythm and get good on camera, they were very comfortable, you know, arguing with each other, disagreeing with each other. And it wasn't necessarily an act. I mean, they might have played it up a little bit when they were on The Tonight Show or on Letterman or something, because that was good television and that's what the people wanted to see. But it wasn't fake or inauthentic. And I think that was very important for their success, is that when you watch some of these appearances and you see them on Letterman fighting with each other, sometimes about movies, sometimes more commonly, like, who gets to tell a story? That was always a big thing. Like, I want to talk. I want to sit next to the host. I don't want to let you get the best line. I don't want you to get the most laughs. You can see them fighting over that in a lot of different appearances. And I suppose if you didn't like them, it might become a little frustrating. But if you were a fan, it was absolutely part of the charm, is that these guys really can't stand each other. And it really hit home that they had this oil and water chemistry. And, you know, in the world of talk shows, to your question, like, in the world of talk shows, everybody likes everybody. Everybody's happy to be there. Everybody's smiling. Everybody's there promoting a project that... I'm so proud of this movie. I'm so excited people are going to get to see it. Let's throw to a clip that whole kind of smiles and happiness vibe. And then in walk Gene and Roger, and they would come right out after somebody who was there promoting a movie and say, actually, that movie wasn't very good. We've seen it. We're going to be reviewing it on the show this week. It stinks. It's thumbs down. I don't think you should go see it. And, it would make you kind of stand up, because it was so different than that collegial, chummy vibe that everybody else was doing on there. And, you know, and again, it was bringing a little bit of reality to this artificial world of television and late night and talk shows. And it made them absolutely stand out in that world. So that certainly was a big part of their appeal on television, on their show and on other shows as well.
Well, I should mention that Gene Siskel was with the Chicago Tribune and Roger Ebert was with the Chicago Sun-Times and competitive papers, that whole fun thing. But I don't know if I heard this the last time when we tried this the last time, or during another conversation I heard prepping for this that you were having, but there was apparently a phone call that was made to cancel the other guy's interview. What was that? You know what I'm talking about?
I think so. Yeah. So they would, you know, they really were competitors. They did work for rival newspapers in Chicago for 6 years before they ever worked together on the show. And even once the show was successful, they were still rivals pretty much for their entire careers. And while, you know, they did eventually kind of get along better and maybe fought less intensely, that rivalry was real. And it in the beginning of their relationship and their working relationship together on the show, it could be very intense. And there was the story that multiple people told me that worked on the show in slightly different versions. But basically the gist was always the same, which was that in this particular instance, there was an interview scheduled by Roger with this actress, Natasha Yakinski, who was a very hot young actress at the time, and sort of like hot like literally they thought she was very, very attractive. If you watch old episodes, you can hear them kind of fawning over how beautiful she is, which she absolutely is a beautiful woman. But and so she was like, this was a, not only was she popular, like they both liked her. This was an exciting interview, not just because it's with a big movie star. The chance to go talk to this woman would be very personally exciting for either of these men. And this interview had been scheduled, and this was during their days at WTTW, still at the PBS station. And I guess at the PBS station, there was a large conference room that they often used to work in. And it had this long table in the conference room. And supposedly, for whatever reason, Gene Siskel liked to take little naps under the table when they weren't like in between recordings of episodes, or if they were taking a break or something. He was tired, he needed a little rest between things. He would like go in this conference room, use his jacket or something as a pillow, and just like lay down and pass out under the desk. And on this particular occasion, Roger went into the conference room to use the telephone, and there was another producer working in there as well, just on his own thing. And this is one, the producer who said he was in the room when this happened was the one who was telling me the story. So he's in the room. Roger comes in. He like calls to confirm the interview with Natasha Kinski on the phone there. And then he gets up and leaves, never realizing that Gene Siskel was under the table. And Siskel was napping, wakes up when Roger comes in and is doing this. He hears him. And when Ebert leaves the room, Siskel gets up, goes back to the phone, redials the number, and says, "Oh yes, hello. This is Mr. Ebert's assistant. I'm so sorry. He actually just realized he has a conflict on that day. He's going to have to cancel the interview. We'll reschedule it another time. Thank you so much." And hangs up. And he does this in front of the producer has been sitting there this whole time watching this all occur. And supposedly Siskel turned to the guy and said, "Not one word, you effer." And he didn't say effer, but you can figure out what he actually said.
"Why the fuck not?
Eric!
Dude, you just said fuck again!
Stanley!
Luke!
Kenny!
What's the big deal? It doesn't hurt anybody. Fuck, fuckity, fuck, fuck, fuck."
But that's a very famous story in Siskel and Ebert lore, and indicative of the sort of relationship they had. And generally, most of the stories that I heard went in that direction. It was a lot of Siskel pranking and kind of needling Ebert. Ebert would maybe verbally needle him back, but the big kind of pranks like that were often, at least the ones that I heard about, were often Siskel doing them, and poor Ebert being the butt of those pranks.
Well, with so much material and such, how did you go about the format of putting together the book?
The format was really based on kind of feeling like, as a fan of the show growing up, that I wanted to make a book that was both the stories like the one I just told, because I had heard some of these stories before, like because I had gotten to work briefly on some of the later versions of At the Movies after Gene had passed away, after Roger had become sick and couldn't work on the show, and the show's kind of continued on without them for a little while. I got to work on one of the two versions of the show, one of which I got to work with a few of the people who had worked with Gene and Roger, like the production staff. So when I was doing that, I would always ask it for stories then, because I loved the show. I was such a huge fan, and I just really wanted to hear what they were like. And I had the questions that I'm sure a lot of people reading the book potentially would have, which is like, did they really hate each other? And what were they like? And were they fighting off camera and all these things? And so I had heard some of the stories like that one. And so I wanted there to be the book to have that stuff in it. But also as a fan of the show, I know what a huge impact the show had on me as a film lover, aspiring film critic, instilling my own love of film and film criticism. So I also wanted to make sure that the book wasn't just gossip and dishy stories. I wanted it to also be about movies and the impact that these guys had on filmmakers, filmmaking, film going. And so that kind of dictated the structure and what to include. Is I tried to balance it pretty evenly between those two things. And if you look at the chapters, they kind of alternate, where I kind of go through their history together, but also like in between two different chapters of their history and like the stories, you'll get a chapter about, you know, some of the filmmakers that they helped champion, or filmmakers they inspired. Or, there's a chapter that's largely about like how the nuts and bolts of writing a Siskel and Ebert review using like a guide that they had provided for guest critics. So it's sort of going back and forth between that. So that was really how I structured it. Was I wanted to get both in there, and sort of alternating between the two seemed like the best way to do that.
Now, if I remember this correctly, back in the day during your college days and even post-college, there was a Friday night ritual where you'd read Ebert's reviews. But what was it about his writing that really had an impact on you?
What I always loved about his writing was that he had this ability to write so eloquently and beautifully and movingly. Or humorously, whatever it was, about any movie. And it didn't matter if it was the lowest brow comedy or the highest brow art film. He could write about any of them equally well and have insights and interesting, entertaining things to say about them. You didn't have to be interested even in the movie he was reviewing to read it. They were interesting to read and enjoyable to read, separate from the movie themselves, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do. But I also felt like the other aspect was that he just had this knack for making things feel accessible. And when he was writing about, you know, higher brow things, art house films, foreign films, older films, he did it in a way that made you like want to see them, that you would read, you know, every other week. At that time, he had this great movies column where every other week he would induct a movie into his like great movies pantheon, and he would write about them. And sometimes they were fairly mainstream movies that you would have known, like Star Wars or Jaws or, you know, whatever it might be. And then other times they would be movies that, at least back then, I would have never even heard of before, and this is my first time discovering these things. And, you know, when you were reading them in those contexts, it wasn't like, well, you know, you haven't seen Last Year at Marion Bad. What's wrong with you? Get it together. It was more like, well, this movie is very interesting, and here's why it's interesting. And here's why, even though maybe it might sound dense or incomprehensible or obtuse or difficult or whatever it might be, here's why it's actually very approachable and interesting and relatable to you, the current modern reader of my review here. And so you would be inspired not only to see the movies, but you would want to write about the movie yourself. Never as well as he did, but it was that kind of accessible, enthusiastic love of movies that really permeated his writing, and it was infectious, and it was fun to discover these things through his writing. And so that's why that was a ritual, more Friday afternoons than Friday nights. Although, I mean, what's the difference? I was probably watching movies on Friday nights anyway. It's not like I was doing anything more exciting than that. But yeah, I used to come home from class in college on Fridays and go right to my computer, because this is pre-cell phones and smartphones and the internet on your phone. And you would go to suntimes.com/Ebert, and all his reviews for the week would be there. And you'd just sit there and read them. And then me and some buddies, yeah, we usually would like sit around. And as we were going to the movies on campus or running the movies on campus later, or, you know, whatever we were doing, we would be chatting about the reviews that week, or how are we going to get to go see whatever movie it was that he wrote about that sounded really interesting. Yeah, that was the dorky crap that I did. Yes.
Good answer. Good answer. I like the way you think.
But the book is Opposable Thumbs: How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. But I want to ask you a couple things on current things going on in the movie world, because you are involved with Screen Crush. So, first one being, there was a recent announcement I heard of This Is Spinal Tap 2 being announced. And maybe it's just me, but it's also going to be like another project I want to bring up. And being, do I have every right to be concerned because the one was such a cult classic that two can be, with the time difference from one and two, they're being a little concerned?
About Spinal Tap 2?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it seems reasonable. I mean, the folks who made the original Spinal Tap are all involved, but when was the last time that they made something that was on the level of Spinal Tap 1 or even close to the level of that? It's been a little while. So, you know, I always approach these things hoping for the best. Maybe it'll be great. Spinal Tap is one of my favorite comedies ever made. Hopefully the sequel will be worthwhile. The fact that they're making a new one now after 40 years or something, like, I presume they could have made another one at some point in the past if they had wanted to. So I would hope that it's not just an excuse to make money, although I'm sure that's part of it. I would hope that
it's always a factor.
Sure. And, you know, look, you got to make money. I don't begrudge anybody that. I just hope that they have a reason to do it beyond the money, that there is some sort of, you know, story that they came up with now, as opposed to 10 or 20 years ago, that that they, you know, that there's a reason to make it now as opposed to make it then, that feels like a good reason to make a Spinal Tap sequel all these years later. I don't know what the premise of the movie is beyond the obvious. I don't know for certain that they have one. I just hope that they have one. And I guess we will have to wait and see. You know, hopefully they do. Oh, hopefully it's not a waste of everyone's time.
The one that I've been hearing a lot of negative feedback for, and it's been out since we tried this the first time, is Roadhouse, Jake Gyllenhaal in Hulu. Have you had a chance to watch it yet?
Sorry, we're closed. Well, then what are all these people doing here? Drinking and having a good time. Well, that's why we're here. You're too stupid to have a good time.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime, not Hulu. But yeah, I watched it, and I enjoyed it. It's different from the original in some ways. It's very similar in other ways. But I thought, you know, there's a case where when I heard they were remaking it, I mean, I was horrified. Not because I think that the original movie is a sacrosanct classic that must never be touched.
Yeah,
more the opposite. It's like, this is a ridiculous, silly movie that was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime lightning-in-a-bottle situation. How do you remake something that's so of its moment and is so over-the-top and so ridiculous and seems like a lot of the things that make it entertaining are either accidental or just kismet, where you could never intentionally recreate this in a way that feels the same way? So when I heard they were doing that, I was pretty skeptical, but I think that they found a way to kind of take the basics of the original movie and do them in a new way that felt to me different enough. And it wasn't a simple case of, well, we're just going to rehash this and we're going to try to make the same winking, you know, campy, bizarre, sort of over-the-top action movie. It's still an over-the-top action movie, but it has a different sort of tone. And, you know, I think Jake Gyllenhaal is doing some interesting things in it, playing the main character, the Patrick Swayze character. So I liked it. I thought it was much better than it had any right to be, having heard that they were going to remake Roadhouse. That was a tall order, and somehow I felt that they pulled it off.
I want you to be nice until it's time to not be nice.
And full disclosure, and fans who are hearing this know that I have relationships with multiple people involved with the original. So that's where part of the skepticism comes from. but I am probably going to be watching it in the next day or two so I can form my own opinion. The other one, which I was fortunate enough to see on Thursday, opening day, was Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire. What were your thoughts with that?
Oh, Ghostbusters. I mean, that's a movie that I love the original so much. It's also one of my favorite movies, favorite comedies. And, I thought I would have wanted another one for many years because I was such a huge fan. But I have not been a fan of either of the two recent ones. I thought this one was a little bit better than the previous one, Ghostbusters Afterlife. I felt like this one at least kind of had a little bit more of like the old school Ghostbusters flavor than the last one, which certainly referenced the original movie a lot, but just didn't feel to me like a Ghostbusters movie at all, despite the fact that it had, you know, proton packs and the Ecto-1 and all the monsters and ghosts from the original movie were in it in some form or fashion. It just felt more like a knockoff Steven Spielberg movie to me, with all these kids running around and, you know, a lot of magic hour sunset shots in Oklahoma, just very bizarre. And then the stuff with Harold Ramis's character, didn't really care for any of that at all. So this one, at least, it's in New York. It has a little more of the energy of the old Ghostbusters, I think. And I really enjoyed seeing Dan Aykroyd in the new movie playing Ray again. You know, he co-created the concept. He wrote the first couple of movies. And it's very clear through the years that he's been one of the people who's been really trying to make another Ghostbusters. He's always wanted to make one. He's, you know, you can, I'm sure if you're a fan, you know, like all the times he tried to write Ghostbusters 3. When Harold Ramis was still alive, they tried to do it. They couldn't get Bill Murray involved and they couldn't get an idea off the ground. And, you know, finally, and he was in the last one very, very briefly. And in this one, he has much more of like a supporting, a real role. And he is making a meal out of every moment, you know, and you can just see he's having so much fun getting to say the ridiculous, you know, the mumbo jumbo Ghostbusters, you know, full roaming phantasms and class 5 vapors and all these sorts of nonsense phrases that maybe they're not nonsense. Maybe to him it all makes perfect sense in their real terms. Who knows? But he believes it so sincerely and he looks like he's having so much fun. I wished I had more fun because I didn't think the movie really worked all that well around him. It's a big mess. It has so many characters. And the story is really janky and all parts of it that are just kind of hanging all over the place where you feel like they cut down a 3-hour movie into almost half that length or a little more than half that length. And there's parts that don't make any sense. But, you know, I felt good for Dan Aykroyd. You know, the guy finally got to make another Ghostbusters movie. He's having a great time. It's very clear. He's so happy. So that was nice. So I, you know, like I said, a small step up from the last one, but overall still kind of a disappointment to me.
You could accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr. Yes. Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
And the final thing, and this was an article I saw you post it recently, was you revisited one of my favorites, and I did a watch party of this last year, of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So what was it like revisiting that classic movie? Because, and I should mention, there's so many fun faction notes with this film, but this was the first film where the animation didn't appear to be tacked on with that, and was involved with the storytelling and plot and all that stuff. But what was it like to revisit that movie?
Well, what surprised me was, first of all, I mean, it still looks great, you know, however many years later. And you know, we've had movies since then, a lot of movies that try to kind of integrate animation and live action components, and so many of them still to this day don't look all that great. And here was this movie made, you know, 30 plus years ago, and it just looks great. all of the gags about that works beautifully. It's such an interesting and fun world that they built for the movie, based on a book, obviously, although very different from the book, from what I understand. I've never read the novel, but it seems quite different than the actual
plot. Who censored Roger Rabbit?
Right. But the other thing that was that I took away from revisiting it was just how, you know, obviously, like, I remember when it came out, it was a huge deal, and it was, you know, credited with helping to kind of reignite interest in new animation and also in old animation, like, you know, because at that time you didn't see a lot of new content being made with Mickey Mouse and the Looney Tunes and all those classic characters, and they were all in Roger Rabbit. I mean, if they were popular, there's no way they would have allowed them to be in Roger Rabbit. That would have gotten shut down, I'm sure. But the fact that they were kind of at kind of a low ebb of popularity and usage was what made it possible. And the fact that they were in there really enhanced the world of the movie and the idea of this reality where cartoons exist with people. And so it was considered very influential at the time. But looking back on it now, you realize, in some ways, it's a template for a lot of movies, not just movies that involve classic cartoons or blend literal, like, animation with live action. Like, just that world, the world building of it, and the idea of creating almost like a cinematic universe where Mickey and Bugs coexist and all these characters live together. And we're going to put all of these Easter eggs into the movie, where if you know classic animation, you're going to get a whole extra layer of meaning out of it. You don't have to know them, but if you are a fan of Clarabelle the cow, like, her appearance is going to mean a whole lot to you, whereas to somebody else, it's just going to be another random animated cow. And the way that all of those elements are in there, it did kind of make me think, like, as important as the movie is... was, and I guess still is, considered, like, maybe we don't give it enough credit for being one of the first movies that really showed how potentially popular and successful that sort of style of deep nerd lore as a universe, as a currency, could be, because there weren't too many films that exist before that that have that sort of vibe, where they're rewarding smart, attentive, knowledgeable, nerdy, dorky viewers. And we're really playing to nostalgia and all of that sort of stuff. So in some ways, I think that it really is, you know, like, this, not only is it an entertaining movie, but it seems to me like a very, very important movie in the history of Hollywood, maybe more important than it's given credit for.
And I won't get into the nerdy stuff that Gary, the author of the book, and Roger's daddy, as we all like to joke. I won't get into some of the stories he's told me on and off air about, because obviously the movie was made before DVD, where we could freeze frame and all that fun stuff. You know, there's some of the nuggets like you mentioned earlier. But now that Opposable Thumbs has been out, obviously I mentioned Screen Crush, which you're heavily involved with. What's next and what's coming down the pike for you?
We'll see. I'm working on some new ideas for another book. We'll see which one kind of takes off. And yeah, I'm just working every day at Screen Crush. That's about it.
And where can people find you if they wish to find you?
ScreenCrush.com is definitely the place to go to read reviews and articles and things like that. You can find me on Letterboxd. Love Letterboxd. I think my username there, though, is like at SuperPulse. It's not, I don't think it's at Matt Singer, but most other places I'm at Matt Singer. Like, if you use Blue Sky, I'm on there. I guess I'm still technically on Twitter. I don't use it very much, but I am still on there. So you can find me there at Matt Singer. Usually sharing stuff that I've written on there. And yeah, there's some other places. I guess Instagram, I also am, I think, at SuperPulse. But yeah, I'm around. You can find me.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey there, Friday fans. We know how much you enjoy the movies. Enjoy grabbing your Friday merchandise and interacting with the Friday family, whether it be at conventions or during our particular watch-alongs. Well, when you're looking to get yourself masks, why not check out our friends over at Camp Blood Customs out of New York State and order your specific custom mask from any of the films. All orders are made specifically. Your needs and wants are. Make sure you find Camp Blood Customs on Facebook, Instagram, and all over social media and order yours today.
Hey y'all, this is Adam Marcus, writer and director of Jason Goes to Hell and Secret Santa, and you are taking a ride on Crazy Train Radio. Badass.